Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price. You want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Price match applies to same item. Current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at Lowe's.com/lowest price guarantee.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Shelley Sykes. It's January 20th, 2022. So do you remember where you were 1 year ago today, what you were doing, Tim Miller? Did you remember that?
I was crying. I was crying, I think, watching
happy
that
tears,
happy tears. I'm kind of like I'm crying this morning after watching Nikola Jokic. I was up late last night watching Nikola Jokic, just beautiful 49-point triple-double game-winning pass, which has me, you know, a little cloudy this morning, but I'm ready for this. And it was a similar type of happy tears, but even more flowing last year, you know, watching that butterscotch bronzered just piece of garbage have to fly away. I was just watching him fly away, and then I came right here to the same room I'm in to talk about it with you on the podcast. It's kind of an emotional podcast, as I recall. Maybe I should have re-listened to it.
There was a lot of drinking during the podcast. Remember, I actually wore a tuxedo on the podcast for a Zoom call. But so this seems like a long time ago.
It does.
It's only been a year.
A lot of broken, you know, hopes and dreams and all of it. But I want to cling to that image. I actually went back and I was looking at my, you know, the pictures that I took and some of the images. And it doesn't get old seeing him, this little man, walking out of the White House to get into the helicopter, you know, leaving the White House. I wanted to watch it on a loop. So for people who say, well, yeah, buyer's remorse about Joe Biden. You know, I've been disappointed by a lot of things, but no, absolutely not. Not even a scintilla, because Donald Trump had to do that walk of shame, you know, didn't go to the inauguration. I mean, as petulant as possible. You know, remember, he gives that weird rambling speech at the airport. Have a nice life, people. And then he gets
what a child. Yeah. Buyer's remorse. Are you kidding me? It was one of the five happiest days of my life. I'm not going to rank them. Every time I rank the happiest days of my life, my husband gets mad about where he falls on the list. But it was up there, one of the five happiest days of my life. And such a child. And he could have done, you know, like no dignity. I always do look back in these images. You get these assholes, the anti-Trump assholes on Twitter, who are like, well, you know, the Democrat, I'm sure we'll get into this about the press conference too. The Democrats tried to delegitimize the thing. And I'm always like, here's the picture of Obama sucking it up and sitting down next to Donald fucking Trump 2 days after he won in the White House. Like, here's the picture of all the staff looking like they want to cry and you know, being sad, watching Donald Trump come into the White House. We don't have those pictures, because what we got to watch was the just man baby just, you know, going home to play with his toys, shuffling out of the White House with his diaper on and flying back to Mar-a-Lago, because he just didn't have the, you know, cojones to show up to shake his hand, shake the
which everybody else, you know, yeah, you think about it, you know, it's maybe up until then we had taken it for granted, you know, Herbert Hoover. Seriously. Sitting there next to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That must have been a lot of fun, right?
Seriously.
You know, Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower did not get along, trust me. I mean, these moments where, you know, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, right? They were there. He was still alive. Yeah. You can imagine. I mean, just think about it. Al Gore sitting there with George W. Bush. George H.W. Bush sitting there with Bill Clinton, this snot-nosed kid from Arkansas who had just defeated him, you know, one-term president. And there he was sitting there. Not only did he suck it up and sit there, but he wrote that really gracious letter on the way out, which, of course, is it's utterly impossible to imagine Trump doing it. And maybe we don't care about that anymore. Well, I mean, again, Richard Nixon sitting with John F. Kennedy, and there is Donald Trump heading off by himself. Okay, so
thank you for making me think about this. I'd forgotten about my joy of that morning, and I'm on a little high now. Right now, I'm on a cloud, just sort of remembering.
Well, I'm going to bring you enjoy this while you can. Okay, I just figured we'd back into this because I have a number of favorite stories this morning, including I've been anxiously waiting for the reaction from Mar-a-Lago to the Supreme Court's spanking of Donald Trump. Yeah, schlonging, saying, you do not have the right to, we're not going to go along with your attempt to obstruct the investigation into your behavior on January 6th. 7-1, only Clarence Thomas, asterisk there, because, you know, the word recusal is going to come up enough. Clarence Thomas, husband of Ginny Thomas.
Pro-coup.
I mean, not only pro-coup, but as I pointed out earlier this week, she'd signed a letter just in the last month saying that Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney should be expelled from the House GOP conference because they're serving on the committee. And so, look, I do think you ought to give a lot of leeway to what spouses do, right? Your spouse does not speak for you. You should not be held accountable. On the other hand, you know, her name is very likely to show up in some of these documents, in some of this testimony. And so there's Clarence Thomas going, "Nope, I think we got to cover it up." Absolutely not. No, I don't think we should turn it over. If that is not a conflict of interest, what the fuck is, really? You know? So anyway, you know the gnashing of teeth because of Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and even Amy Coney Barrett. And all of them said, yeah, we're not going to be part of the cover-up. We may go along with you on abortion, a variety of other stuff, you know, whatever, you know, mandates. But on this, no, we don't even want to get close to it.
It is joyful because he doesn't understand. He doesn't get it. He still doesn't get it. And has this loyalty expectation that is deformed and privileged and, you know, based on, you know, his childhood and, you know, the deal and the deals that he always screwed people over on as a real estate man. He doesn't get it. And I, you know, look, Amy Coney Barrett would not have been my first choice for a Supreme Court justice. And Brett Kavanaugh isn't really my cup of tea, but and the Gorsuch seat was basically stolen. So I wouldn't have said that originally, but it was, you know, if you balance Gorsuch and Coney Barrett. So I have my problems with them. But he didn't understand for the start that he was not, you know, the deal that he had cut, the deal with the devil, you know, between Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society and Trump, you know, that the Republican establishment would go full throat for him as long as he signed off on these judges. He still thought that these judges were going to be on the team.
He did.
Like wearing a jersey. Yeah. Like he didn't understand that all these people did have pre-existing actual principles and beliefs. And even if you disagree with some of their principles and beliefs. And, you know, I think correctly were worried, you know, when he was running, that he would, you know, appoint Judge Jeanine or whatever to the Supreme Court.
Next time around, he
had to cut that deal because, you know, he wanted to demonstrate that he was, you know, pro-life, or whatever, and make sure he could get the social conservatives on board during the primary. Next time around, I think he has learned his lesson on that point for sure.
The Senate would let him get away with it, which of course they probably would. Okay, so here's my second favorite story of the day. Not the most important story, but I just find it highly entertaining. This is from Politico Playbook, Trump's big lie of a gift. Every House Republican, every single one of them, received a present Wednesday from Donald Trump's outside group Save America. They handed out copies of, are you ready for this? Molly Hemingway's conspiratorial book, Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Election, along with a signed note from the former president. So here's Donald Trump flogging Molly Hemingway's book, you know, to push the big lie. And he writes on the note, Republican leadership should never have certified the election on January 6th. Still there. And now Democrats will never stop their assault on America, Trump writes. I hope you find this book informative and encouraging in your battle for the heart of our nation. Playbook notes, political playbook notes. Well, Kevin McCarthy led more than 100 House Republicans in objecting to the election that day. The GOP leader has been trying to pivot away from 2020, right, and focus on Biden ahead of the midterms. But as a House GOP aide who tipped us off said, Trump's gift is the latest sign that the leader of the party does not want that and expects House Republicans to fall in line. Just shows how Trump is continuing to pressure members and Republicans to embrace the big lie, the person said. So first of all, Molly Hemingway must be so proud since she's become Serenity a total now. Show. Well, okay. And, you know, and she actually, okay, yeah, this is, now I'm going to go down a rabbit
all right,
hole.
I'm ready.
Could you say I'm here from Milwaukee and we're the home of the Bradley Foundation, which used to be one of the real pillars of the intellectual conservative movement here, funded, you know, almost every single conservative thinker, book, think tank, university, you name it. And
I have a prediction. I don't know what's happened to the Bradley Foundation, but I bet it's been degraded and become a MAGA cesspool.
Well, let me tell you how bad it's become a MAGA cesspool. Okay. And I need to, I mean, you know, in quasi full disclosure, my wife used to work there. I had close ties with them. I knew a lot of the folks, was really good friends with the former presidents of it, but it has become a MAGA cesspool. And here's the measure of it. Every year they hand out the so-called Bradley Prize, which is this, you know, big sort of crystal lion with a big freak load of money that goes with it. And it used to be people like George Will who would win that. This year, are you ready? They gave it to Molly Hemingway. I mean, this is, okay, I'm now, are you working on the Serenity here?
I'm breathing.
This is a $250,000 prize. And it used to be to the most important, thoughtful conservatives in the country. And they gave it to Molly Hemingway, who is such an embarrassing shill that Trump is using her books to send out telling Congress that they shouldn't have certified January 6th. So this tells you a lot about how deep in the cesspool. I mean, not only are they deep in the cesspool, I mean, they're stirring the cesspool. You know, Cleta Mitchell was a member of the board of the Bradley Foundation. I don't know whether she still is. Remember, she was the attorney who actually was on the call trying to overturn the Georgia election. So anyway,
well, I'm just doing my Ujjayi breaths over here, Charlie. It is a little bit confusing. You know, I do think that I recalled that Liz Cheney lost her role in leadership because she just couldn't move on.
She wouldn't move on. Couldn't move on.
It is disturbing that it's just worth mentioning, like, you know, and just driving home this point, because I do think since, you know, and we will have, as Kinzinger, previewed on this very podcast,
new dad, congratulations.
New dad, yeah. Congrats, yeah. Adam, that there will be some primetime hearings and there will be other news opportunities. But I do think that for people who aren't following this closely, like there's this underbelly of continuing on the 2020 insurrection that is ongoing and that is just not getting the attention that what's happening sensibly, you know, in the White House and people's day-to-day lives, like what the urgent matters, right? Like the things that are affecting people today are getting more attention. And so, you know, these little tidbits happen. You know, you see that the former president's sending a book to everybody in the House, you know, reminding them to stay in line and say that the 2020 election is rigged. He's holding this rally in Arizona, you know, where, you know, the MyPillow man who had the most crazy insurrection conspiracies and who met with the White House and told them to, you know, call the National Guard in. You know, he's speaking. He's, you know, this is still a man in good standing. He's speaking in the lead up to Trump's speech. All of the leading polling candidate for Senate and governor is there, right? Like this stuff is all still happening and ongoing. It just, because we don't have an election right now, and because I think a lot of people are wish casting that maybe Trump will like keel over or get arrested or whatever, that we won't ever have to deal with this. But it's very much a present thing, not a past thing. And the book is just it's just a little example, but it's just one more data point in that regard.
No, it is. And I would urge people, by the way, to read Amanda Carpenter's piece in The Bulwark today. She breaks down the six main, the different ways in which Trump tried to overturn the election. I mean, at a certain point, you almost need a chart, all of the things that are going on. Okay, so let's take a deep breath here. It is 1 year, and Joe Biden does the quote-unquote reset press conference. As I wrote this morning, the optics weren't great because, I mean, it is bracketed by dismal polling, intra-party squabbling, and this historic failure on voting rights. I continue to be baffled by the Democratic strategy in the Senate, which succeeded, I think, primarily in exposing really bitter divisions inside the party, rather than amplifying the fact that the Republicans are blockading voting rights. And so the president comes out, talks about his first year, and the next news cycle is, you know, his agenda crashes and burns in the Senate. It's great. And then there's these polls out showing, well, I mean, they're just not good. So before I go into the slough of negativity and despond, Tim, your thoughts, because I think you had a more positive take on the press conference than I did.
Yeah, well, on the press conference. So I guess I just want to bracket my comments by saying I agree. And we've been saying on this podcast and on others that I've been concerned about some of the president's strategic moves, the Democratic Party's strategic moves. If people haven't read Sarah Longwell's article yesterday talking about the strategic pivot Democrats need to make to deal with their political reality, they should read it. This is not a Pollyannish comment about the Democrats' current political position, which is maybe not dire, but not good. The press conference itself, though, I thought it was pretty good. I don't. So here's my context. I need to give you a little context to this. I couldn't watch it yesterday in real time. I was running out and about. I had some toddler parenting, you know, to attend to, and so I'm watching it on Twitter, right? And I'm seeing everybody, you know, all the Sturm und Drang about his Ukraine comment. Everybody's upset about his elections comment. You know, people are saying he's doddering. I suffered through right wing Twitter. They had all of these, you know, performative things that they were upset about at the press conference. And I was like, man, geez, Biden mustn't have really performed. But I knew it was coming on the podcast. So it's like, I can't judge this based on Twitter. So after watching Nikola Jokic late at night, I sat silently in my room and I watched him on 1.75 speed on the YouTube. So maybe I just want to say that I might be giving him a curve. He might sound more doddering when he's in real time. I was listening to him on 1.75 and I powered through the whole 2 hours. And I thought he was really good. He was generally optimistic.
Just always speed him up like that.
Yeah, a couple of the lifts.
Only he could be electronically enhanced that way.
If we could put him on chipmunks mode, yeah, then he'd be good. Okay, a couple of things I just wrote down. I said on this podcast probably 2 or 3 months ago that they need to pivot and start focusing on inflation and stop focusing so much on, you know, their big ticket spending items. He did that. He even mentioned deficit reduction, you know, during this press conference yesterday. He in both his lead up remarks and his response to the questions, he kept coming back to how they're trying to deal with inflation. I think he's done a good job of making the point that BBB, it might not be addressing grocery store inflation, but prescription drugs, you know, childcare, elder care. I thought at least they have internalized that. This is a message that they have to deal with. You know, because it's not like they have a magic end inflation wand. You know, the best thing they can do is talk about the levers they can do to pull it. He talked about Jerome Powell. I thought that he was pretty good on schools. You know, he talked about how all the money that they've given the schools and how some of them aren't using it very wisely. I was kind of a dig at the teachers union. I thought could have been a little more direct, but he kept reiterating that he wanted schools to be open. I know we're going to talk about this a little bit more later, but I just thought he wanted to mention it. He was good on actually, I think that they have settled on an anti-Republican message that they're driving in addition to the Trump stuff, because Trump alone isn't good enough, as we saw in Virginia. And it's, what do these guys want to do? They have no plan either. Yeah, he kept repeating that. He kept coming back to, you know, this message, which is correct. Republicans are offering nothing. They're just criticizing Biden and not wanting to come to the table. I thought his message was good enough.
And by the way, McConnell underlined that because they asked him a little bit later, so what is your agenda? And he goes, hey, that's a great question, but you'll have to wait until we get back in control or something. Like, wait, seriously? That's your answer? That we're not, yeah, we don't have it, and you have to, like, put us in power and then we will tell you what it's going to be, because you know what it's going to be. It's just going to be obstruction. I mean, it's just like, he doesn't even think about Mitch McConnell is, he doesn't even bullshit about it. It's just like, no. Yeah, we're just going to block everything.
We're just going to block everything.
So next question, like, I mean, what part of everything don't you get? Well, you know, so.
So, yeah, I thought that's, you know, is that a good enough as a message going into November? Probably not. We can talk about that, but at least it's something. You know, he's starting to define the opposite side, which he's not done a particularly good job of. And, you know, little things. I thought he was tough on China versus a couple of questions. He got some crazy, he took crazy questions from, like, not just Fox, but, like, Newsmax and some other troll guy. You asked him about Hunter Biden, and he kept his cool. He answered those questions, and he was up there for 2 hours, which, you know, I don't want to make a big deal out of that, but it's not nothing, okay? I'd like to see some of these other people go, you know, who are, you know, calling him doddering, take 2 hours worth of questions from assholes and see how they do. So I thought overall he was good on the two items that people keep coming back to. Now, communication is a big part of the job, right? So you need to be a clear communicator if you're the president, and if you can't be a clear communicator, you deserve to be criticized. So I'm fine with him being criticized, but what was going around on Twitter was very much not what he said on either of those points, right? On the 2022 legitimacy election point, he was trying to make the point about the count. He kept trying to say, like, well, how do we know if the Republicans are going to monkey with the count? And I think he got frustrated with Wegman, and Psaki cleared that up today. Here's what he said on Ukraine. I wrote this down. He's never seen sanctions like the one I promise will be imposed if he moves, number one. The idea that NATO is not going to be united, I don't buy. I want to be clear with you. Serious imposition of sanctions, devastating impact on Russia if there's Russian forces crossing the border killing Ukrainians. If there's Russian forces crossing the border killing Ukrainians, devastating sanctions. Okay, so look, I'm not Shea Kateri or any of our esteemed foreign policy greats, you know, who've gotten everything wrong over the past 30 years. So maybe they didn't like the specific wording that he used on that. The minor incursion thing, I guess, obviously Ukrainians didn't like it, so it couldn't have been good. But I don't know. I read that, it says if Putin sends troops over, we're going to fuck them up. That's what I read.
I admire your heroic effort there.
Okay.
I stand in awe of that. No, that is what I wish he would have said and then stop.
Right.
Instead, sure. You have the, well, you know, as long as it's a minor incursion, which whatever that means.
It's a weird phrase.
I mean, there are gaffes. You know, then there are gaffes that are just, you know, whatever, you know, maybe telling too much truth in Michael Kinsley definition of a gaffe, or just, you know, mixing up some words. And then there are the gaffes that might actually lead to war. Gaffes that might actually lead to miscalculation, send the wrong signal. And by the way, it's not just Twitter. It's the Ukrainians who are going, what the fuck did he just say? He just gave a green light. Fred Kaplan, you know, wrote about this. Biden suggesting if Putin mounts a minor incursion, then maybe NATO might not be so united. And Fred Kaplan writes, so is Biden saying that Russia might not incur severe costs and significant harm if Putin mounts merely a minor incursion is? And what is a minor incursion? Just another salami slice of eastern Ukraine beyond Russia's 2014 minor incursion into Donbass province, and it's that if you pronounce it that way, and the annexation of Crimea, just a helicopter landing in the capital, just a few airstrikes. And of course, we had the immediate White House cleanup, you know, on aisle 48 here, you know, and, you know, Jen Psaki put, you know, out a statement, you know, saying that he's been clear with, you know, the Russian president, you know, if there's a renewed invasion.
This is a PR flag tick, by the way. Anytime your boss fucks up and is unclear, you always have to say, we've always been clear in the cleanup. Absolutely.
No, and it was not clear, and it was an own goal. But it's one of those things where, with all of his experience, it was, I'm sorry, just kind of breathtaking that he would have wandered off into that, because this was exactly the moment for complete clarity and not throwing into, now, if you do something really big, like, I don't know, maybe a minor incursion, you know, but if it's really big, you might be in trouble. Minor incursion, I'll get back to you on. I just like, no, you don't say that.
Can I tell you what I think he was thinking? And I agree with you. I don't want to make this seem like I'm saying this was perfectly done. My point I was trying to make is I think the rest of the press conference was good, and I think on these two points, he just mangled what he's trying to say, which is different than the you know, I think a lot of the criticism that I saw, which you know, made it seem like this was intentional. I think what's going on in his head is Syria, and I think that the Obama red line, you know, is something that sticks with him. And, you know, he followed up right after the incursion comment, you know, which I didn't write this down, but some kind of line saying, you know, if you're the big power, you know, you can't bluff, right? You have to back up what you say. And I think that he was trying to caveat, because he doesn't want to seem like, oh, I'm guaranteeing we're going to take a big action, and then if something little happens and I don't take anything, then you're going to say I was, you know, I think that's what's going through his head. He worded it poorly. But he did come back. I just want to reiterate this, because it was after the minor incursion comment, they followed up, and it was after that is when he came back and he said that, you know, if there's Russian forces crossing the border, killing Ukrainians, there will be devastating impact. Yeah, so that's what he said after. That would not be minor. Right. That would not be minor. So I guess his point is like, okay, there are a whole suite of things Russia could do in Ukraine that is short of, you know, killing somebody and crossing the border, right? And so it's, you know, who the hell knows what all those things are, right? And I think that's what he was trying to say in his head. Like, you know, if Russia, you know, does a little side, whatever, like, I don't want to be hamstrung into the most severe pushback on Russia, you know, if they're just monkeying around.
Okay, so that's number one. Let's talk about the other one, where he's asked about the legitimacy of the midterm. We have some of the audio of that. Let's just play.
Speaking of voting rights legislation, if this isn't passed, do you still believe the upcoming election will be fairly conducted and its results will be legitimate?
Well, it all depends on whether or not we're able to make the case to the American people that some of this is being set up to try to alter the outcome of the election.
Well, okay. I'm not going to say it's going to be legit when he was asked about the possibility of fraud. The prospect of an illegitimate election is in direct proportion to us being able to get these reforms passed. Look, you know, Josh Jordan tweeted out, look, I was against Trump preemptively claiming the election would be illegitimate if he lost. And I'm against Biden saying that 2022 could be illegitimate if he doesn't get his election bills passed, which he's not going to. Until we have evidence of illegitimate elections, these are dangerous accusations. Here's my concern. And, you know, we talk about Twitter. The number of people out there going, he's absolutely right, tells me that we are really in danger of going into this doom loop in which everybody questions everything, that both sides now have armed themselves with reasons not to respect the outcome of the election. We know the Republicans will come up with any bullshit lie out there, but the Democrats are now convincing themselves that the election, if they lose, it will be illegitimate because the Republicans suppressed the vote and they cheated. And so we are in this kind of doom loop right now where everybody is sort of pre-positioned for illegitimacy. And that's why that wasn't just a gaffe. I think that felt like a preview of the world that we're going to be living in for the next few years.
I think that's a very legitimate concern. And I think that this is, yeah, again, to my point, you know, in my defense of the press conference rant, I do think that he was talking about the count, okay, now, and not, you know, the, oh, you know, if there's suppression or whatever. But he kind of did. That was a shorter quote. He did. Okay, I think so. If he doesn't, though, this needs to be an issue that you are particularly sensitive to the exact language that you're using because of what happened in January. And because of this point that you said, future people not accepting elections, I'm very, you know, I think there's good reason to be very concerned about this. I do think that this is an area where there is a little bit of irrationality that is consuming folks on the left. You know, sometimes I get these questions and, you know, about the dire state of voting rights. And it's, again, what Republicans are doing in the states is not good. It also hasn't demonstrated to work yet. You know, and so yet is a key word. We'll see. You know, maybe in 2022, some of these red states, there will be real suppression. In 2020, it didn't work at all, right? Record turnout. There are plenty of opportunities to vote, you know, and limiting the number of early days. Again, not, that's not what I'm for, but that's not, you know, that doesn't make an election illegitimate. For a long time, we had elections that had very few opportunities to vote early or absentee. So, anyway, point being, he needs to be precise in his language about this. I'm concerned about the left not accepting elections. I don't want to create an equivalence, though, because I think that what Republicans are doing in the states is terrible. I think there is legitimate concern about secretaries of state and other officials in red states, you know, learning from Trump and trying to screw with the count. I think that's a perfectly appropriate red flag to put up. He's just got to watch what he says.
This is the really important distinction here, because I think that is the real threat. So when I say there's an existential threat to democracy, I am talking about January 6th and the entire plot to overthrow that election, the installation of secretaries of states who might throw out vast numbers of votes, legislatures that feel empowered to ignore the popular vote. These are fundamental dangers. None of the bills that were voted on yesterday actually dealt with that. See, this is the disconnect here, that the problem is there's a problem of casting the votes, access to the vote, and then there's the problem of counting the votes. The real problem, the existential problem, is in the counting of the votes. The casting of the votes, look, I understand the people in Georgia who are upset about the elimination of the drop boxes. I understand why they are concerned about really long lines to vote in Fulton County. I get this, okay? But these are not, drop boxes are not an existential threat to democracy. You know, 15 days of early voting as opposed to 10 days of early voting is not an existential issue for democracy.
It's a bad policy, right?
Could I also point out about the Voting Rights Act? And look, I've said before, I would have voted for the John Lewis Act. I wouldn't have voted for HR1 because they pack all kinds of other extraneous stuff in it. But I would have voted for it. But people do need to be reminded that we still have a Voting Rights Act. What the Supreme Court threw out, they gutted a portion of the Voting Rights Act, which required, you know, pre-clearance of any major changes in certain southern states. Okay. But it is still illegal, unconstitutional, to discriminate on the basis of race. If any state takes a step that endangers the votes of Americans, particularly of minorities, there is still a federal law that bans that. There are still litigation. You can still sue. You can still go and enforce it. So the loss of preclearance is a problem, but it does not completely eliminate the voting right. And I guess part of it is this, and I'm sorry to keep coming back to this, the disconnect between the rhetoric and the actual reality, because I had to spend some time yesterday going, okay, specifically, what are we talking about here? What am I missing? You know, is it the, you know, that you can't hand out water to people in line? Well, that's just kind of petty. What's going on in Texas? They're throwing out some votes. But the reality is that by any measure, at least, you tell me if I'm wrong about this, it seems like it's easier to vote pretty much everywhere in the country, easier to vote than it was in, say, 2008 when Barack Obama was first elected president. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I'd have to go look at it. I think that's true if you said 1988, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that's sort of the point, right? In a post-Voting Rights Act world, there was still a lot of, you know, significantly more restrictive voting rules, you know, in the past quarter century than there is now. I think that's true. Obviously they're trying to roll back certain things. I don't agree with that. I think Democrats should particularly be worried about expanding them in purple states where they have control, places like Michigan right now. But yeah, I don't think that's right. I think that the rhetoric on this is overheated. There's a good reason after what happened on January 6th to be upset, but then to sort of conflate that with all of these other items about voting, there are legitimate reasons to want to disagree with, you know, to be honest, I had long held the view that we had too long early voting period. Things can happen in elections at the end of time. And my position had always been, election day should be a holiday. you know, everybody should be able to, you know, get off work and go vote on election day. And, you know, if your boss doesn't let you, you should be able to sue them, right? Like, election day should be a holiday, and that would solve, right? So I think that there are good faith disagreements. I don't think what the Republicans are doing in a lot of these states is good faith. I think it's bad faith.
No, it's based on the
2020. But okay, their intentions being bad, it doesn't change the reality that you just laid out of the fact that these changes are rolling back people's access to voting to, you know, what it was more like 20 years ago, which again, I just want to keep reiterating, I do not support, but that is different than not having a free and fair election. And that is why, try this on for size, like the Biden message should be, we will have free and fair elections. I will make sure we have free and fair elections. And all the Republicans' attempts to try to undermine that, you know, must be rebuked. And we will stop
force
them.
Of law. Yes.
Yeah, with the full force of law, period. And so you attack them still, but reassure people.
Well, exactly. I mean, there are still tools, and the Department of Justice can sue like they are in Texas. Okay, so Governor Youngkin in Virginia.
My friend.
Based on the Twitters, you've been saying some things that are a little controversial.
Boy,
I need to catch up on this.
I don't think that this is controversial, actually, Charlie. Okay. I think it's controversial in the sense that some people are upset. But I here's what I'm concerned about. And I just want to back up a little bit before I get into my controversial, you know, defense of something that Glenn Youngkin did, which I'm sure is not very popular among my new friends. No. The Republicans, in some ways, this parallels this voting rights discussion. The Republicans' actions on COVID have been absolutely unconscionable. And I sent this tweet yesterday. I don't know if you've seen it, about the Utah Senate president. You know, this asshole who's this Republican Senate president in Utah who tested positive for COVID, shows up to work, doesn't wear a mask, first lies about the fact that he tested positive for COVID, then has to admit that he did test positive twice and he still showed up. This is just a microcosm of Republicans' behavior across the country, you know, appeasing the anti-vaxxers, in some cases, DeSantis' case, hiring an anti-vax, you know, a certain general in the state. I mean, their behavior has been horrible. Yeah. And yet somehow, I sense, you know, talking to my non-political friends, you know, looking at the data, the Democrats are letting Republicans take the middle position on a lot of COVID things, particularly as it relates to schools and particularly as it relates to, you know, trying to transition back towards having a path to transition back towards some kind of normality, not pre-COVID normality, but some kind of normality. And I think that the Democrats are making a big mistake here. Like, they should be turning Republicans into the crazy ones because they are crazy and they're acting crazy. And yet, because of the behavior in schools, I really think that they're opening themselves up to being the ones that people are upset at. And this prime example is this mask fight among kids in schools. And I want to be clear. I think that when people are inside in close quarters, they should be wearing a mask, right? And given right now what's happening with Omicron and vulnerable communities, I totally agree with that. But this the treatment of the kids in the schools right now is a little crazy, I think. Having to have separate lunches, permanent masking all the time, masking 8 hours a day. And I mentioned this on the Next Level podcast. So if you already heard this, you can fast forward 30 seconds. If you haven't heard it, sign up for Bulwark Plus. But you see these pictures of the grownups, you know, going to sporting events. Nobody's wearing masks. Everybody's inside. Everybody's partying. Everybody's having a good time. Democrats and Republicans, by the way, this isn't just Republicans. And then you contrast that with the pictures of the kids walking through the schools, you know, like they're in a prison, having to mask. I get that, you know, wearing a mask isn't that big of a sacrifice, but man, like, these kids, they're at the lowest risk of anybody of COVID, and we're making them wear masks 8 hours a day. It's tough. My kid is four. It's fine. It's fine. She's fine. But you're learning your phonics, right? Not seeing people's mouths does matter, right? Like, if you're learning how to read, not being able to read the lips of your teacher, like, that does matter. It's harder to learn new words. It's harder to understand what's being said. And I do feel like it's the Democrats are opening themselves up to a major criticism by saying that, you know, schools, and I thought Biden did a good job of saying schools should be open, but at the local level, sometimes he gets stuck having to respond to local actions at the local level. So some of these schools are closing. These kids are wearing masks, and you know, and then you've got Republican candidates saying, man, if a parent says the kid doesn't want to wear a mask, they should. I think that's a winning political message for the Republicans and for Youngkin right now. And unfortunately, the irresponsible actors are starting to encroach into the big middle on this issue that is very important to people's day-to-day lives. It's tangible. There are people who don't want, you know, to have to stay home and skip work for a day to take care of their kids, you know, and that's different than democracy, right? That's intangible.
Exactly. There are two different categories of like things that people think about in theory and then really tangible.
Right.
You know, gas prices, really tangible. You know, the price of chicken, really tangible. Whether your kid has to wear a mask all day, whether your kid gets to go to school. So as I'm listening to this discussion about the masking, I feel the anger rising in me once again about the anti-vaxxers, the people who have been so reckless, the people who have given out disinformation. And I guess that's where you're going, is that the pivot on this is to say, look, children should be in school. They should not have to wear masks. And the reason that we are even having this discussion is because there has been so much reckless disinformation about the vaccine. The vaccines work. We need to stop having Republican governors lying about this, undermining our efforts to do the healthy thing. The thing that makes is so irrational about the education debate is the fact, and you know this, every parent knows this, there are so many immunizations that you have to have. There are so many shots. In the state of Florida, it takes up an entire page of the website.
Yes.
All of the shots you have to have, even to take your child to daycare. So why do we suddenly have this carve out and say, yes, but absolutely not this one vaccine that may determine whether or not we have school at all? This is the bullshit. So I do think they need to go on offense about the vaccines as opposed to getting bogged down in this other thing. The only reason we're talking about masks is because you assholes are not vaccinating.
Yes. And by the way, if there are certain times like, look, I don't, you know, they're high risk things. You know, we're having a school function. Everybody's, you know, we're singing, you know, Christian Catholic schools, like we're having mass, right? Maybe people should have their masks on, right? Like there are reasonable actions. If you're within a certain, you know, if you tested positive and you know, then you come back a few days later, the kids, right? Like there are all of these rational, reasonable things that we can do, you know, and that turns the Republicans into the ones that are extreme because they are, right? Like, you guys are risking people's lives. Like the answer is not, oh, laissez-faire, live and let die, you know, whatever, you know, versus like COVID zero, right? Like there's this question of how do we transition out of it and who can take the big middle? And I think that if the Democrats, you know, like chose to, they could do that, but there needs to be a little leadership and a little bit of risk, you know, and willing to say, hey, you know, we need to let people who have done the right thing, who've gotten vaccinated, you know, have a little bit of leeway to be responsible, but also reasonable. And I think it's unreasonable to, you know, demand that 6-year-olds who are vaccinated, who are at very low risk, you know, have, you know, who are trying to learn how to read, have to have their mask on 8 hours a day while grownups don't.
No, I completely agree. So, all right. So you tweeted out 13 hours ago.
Okay.
A thought
experiment. A lot of tweets.
I know. But this was thought provoking.
Yeah. Thanks.
You asked an interesting question. And I think it's legitimate because people are saying, boy, you know, this has been really a tough year for Joe Biden. It's been a terrible year for Joe Biden, which it has been. But then you asked a thought exercise on the Biden 1-year mark. What is the best calendar year for a president in the post 9/11 internet era? You got 20 to choose from.
It's tough, isn't it? Everybody's thinking about that for a second.
There is a correct answer, but I'm guessing that your point was, as you go through it, you realize there has not been in this century, there hasn't been really a good year for a president. They've been like various shades of shitty, right?
Yeah.
Okay, shitty, but you survived it. But when was the last time a president had a really good year?
I think there's the right answer. I probably should have started at 2003, but rather than 2002, because 2002 is probably the right answer.
That
with
is
Bush.
The right answer. Yes.
though. 2011, I think you can make a pretty decent case for 2011. We killed Osama bin Laden and got out of Iraq, but he didn't do a whole lot. The Republicans had just taken over the House, so there wasn't a lot of legislative achievement that year. But 2011 would be my runner-up.
I don't know. If you're the president, you've just lost control of Congress. Right. You have the Tea Party that is raging. All bipartisan negotiation has stopped. I remember the economy being so crappy that by the end of the year, one prominent Republican was saying, you know, if Republicans can't beat Obama next year, they ought to get out of this business because things are going so badly about all
of this.
Was that
Sarli Kikes?
No, it wasn't. Somebody else. I wish I would have said that, even though it would have been wrong. But so you agree with me. Because I actually spent some time on this, and I came up with 2002 when you think about the last, you know, really strong year for a president. I mean, George W. Bush had a shaky election, shaky first year. The country came together after 9/11. He was able to actually win in the midterm elections. There was a sense of national purpose, of national unity. Things, of course, went south with Iraq later, with Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, they weren't in Iraq yet. They went into Iraq in early 2003.
I mean, they went later. But I'm saying, in 2002, you know, the country did have, there was that moment when I think you had that sort of national purpose, national unity that seems like a different era. I just don't know that we could ever get back to that again.
This is 19 years ago, right? I mean, that's what I'm saying. So now if you start the thought exercise of 2003, it's like, man, someone else offered Obama the 2015 year because, you know, you get gay marriage and stuff. But again, he doesn't accomplish anything really that year legislatively. And then Trump comes 2016, right? So it's like, how great could it have been really? I think that some of this speaks to, you know, deeper challenges about like the internet and the way we consume news and the divide in our country, right? Like, is it possible to have a good presidency, you know, in a time when you don't have three, you know, news networks with the sort of scrutiny of the day-to-day internet stuff? Maybe that, you know, the internet is a big part of it that divides, you know, post 9/11. Some of the choices of our leaders obviously have created this, but you pick a year. And then you look at the previous 20 years, you know, you go from 81 to 2001, and it's like the best year for a president from 2001 to 2021 is like in the bottom 5 years from 81 to 2001. I mean, they have mostly good years. Bush had a bad year right before he loses, and Clinton has a bad year when he got in trouble with his little pickle. But like a lot of good years for the presidents. Obviously, they made some mistakes with the benefit of hindsight and all that. Not saying that those guys were perfect, but the culture, the political environment was just so different then than now. I just think that puts a little bit of a broader context on Biden's struggles.
This is a very interesting question, is whether you can have a successful presidency anymore. And also, but what defines a successful presidency? Again, this is one of those things, and I was, you know, thinking about if I had to give a letter grade to Joe Biden, I'm still working on this. Do you evaluate a presidency based on the policy issues? I mean, I understand that people would say, look, he got, the big stimulus package through, which was a significant legislative accomplishment, the infrastructure bill through, which, you know, in Earth 2.0, the Republicans, the Democrats would be saying, this has really been a good year. Look at this, these $1 trillion pieces of legislation. Job market is good. The economy appears to be good. So there are these measurements, these metrics of presidential success. But then you have the sense that then why do people feel so shitty? Why do they not have a sense of optimism? Why do they not think the country is headed in the right direction? Because that's also determines whether or not you feel, you know, can you be a successful president if people are not feeling good about the country and the direction the country is going? So do you judge the president based on the metrics or the policy, or do you judge him based on the mood? And by the way, mood is not, I'm not trying to trivialize it. I'm saying that there, This is the sort of the heart of the Biden failure, is that despite some of these policy wins, which are considerable, which Democrats have decided not to celebrate, but the country just doesn't have that sense of hope and optimism that we thought it was going to have this year. Right.
Yeah. And I think that there's this question of, is this possible? Are we so divided?
Is it possible?
Right. That you can't have a good mood because 40% of the country is going to hate you no matter what. It's possible. I think that with the benefit of hindsight, you know, I got a lot of answers to that question. 2002 and 2011 were the most popular ones. But 2010 was also a really popular answer, because if you look at 2010, Obama passes Affordable Care Act, passes Dodd-Frank. During the lame duck, they pass, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So on paper, you know, particularly if you're left of center, you look at that and you say, I mean, we tried 50 years to pass a healthcare bill. Dodd-Frank was important, you know, post-crash legislation. Obviously, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was long overdue. Okay, but that lame duck happens in the context of just getting absolutely annihilated at the polls, yeah. Right? And so I think that it's possible you look back at 2021 with a similar view 10 years on, which is like this COVID relief bill. I don't think people realized how much, you know, it helped buoy the economy and, you know, get us, you know, jumpstart us. Maybe it jumpstarted us a little too hot with inflation temporarily, but, you know, prevent the long recovery that we saw during Obama. You look at the infrastructure and think, man, all this stuff, you know, 10 years from now, when you got your new airport built and things, like, thank God we did that, right? But meanwhile, his political standing is dropping the whole time. Maybe there's an answer to it. I don't think, you know, you don't want to throw in the towel and say there's nothing he could have done. I think there are things Biden could have done better, obviously. This was not a thought exercise to get him to A+. I think it does demonstrate that, you know, there's something about the structure, you know, the gridlock we have in D.C. and our cultural divide that's making it really hard to have a good year.
Yeah, the happiness is not a fixed thing. It's always your circumstances versus your expectations of your circumstances, right? So no matter no matter how good things are, if you thought that they should be so much better, and as you point out, if there are this cacophony of voices constantly tell you things suck, it's right. Terrible, you know, and that volume is rising, because it's not just that people that are telling you that, you know, things could be a lot better, or, you know, here's some missed opportunities. It's like your country is going down the tubes. It's apocalypse now all the time. And there's a certain anxiety. There is a kind of a disconnect, because you kind of look around and you go, hey, you know, my life is actually pretty good, right? I mean, you know, the sun is out. It may be a little bit chilly. You know, people are still moving around the country. Most people, you know, have jobs. And if by the way, if you're working at a sucky job, you can now, this is a moment where you can quit that sucky job and get a better one that pays good money and all of these things. And yet, you know, what the voice in your head is telling you, it's the end. It's over. Everything is terrible. It's carnage. So
I don't know. About this getting worse, it's not just getting worse, and it's also getting worse in the way that we're communicating. And I think that there are a lot of other things here, but I don't think it's coincidence that the internet, you know, the rise of the web has coincided with this, and making it much more challenging to be a president because of just the amount of, you know, information and doom porn that's in people's ears. And I'm telling you, Charlie, like, I suck down the devil's playground from time to time over on TikTok, and it's horrible. I mean, like, you know, you don't come across a lot of TikToks that are, you know, from teens talking about how great things are going. You know, it is all doom and gloom, you know, from both MAGA teens and, you know, more progressive teens about how they aren't doing anything and, you know, et cetera. So I just think that there's something about our communications tools that are a big contributor to this that's a little bit, to figure out how you navigate.
That's the problem when people say, what's the solution to it? It is not easy. I think a lot of people are just simply going to withdraw. You're going to, you know, go off into the metaverse and never be heard from again. I mean, maybe that's the end point of Western civilization, is we all go into the holodeck and never come out.
Backlash, right, against it. And, you know, we have an era of good feelings coming down the pike. No?
I would like to think that. But see, this is the other thing. There's the technology, which also could bring on the era of good feelings, but there's so much bad faith out there. The bad faith argumentation, the people who have a vested interest in keeping the outrage, you know, it is an industry that thrives on keeping people afraid and angry. And it's upping the ante. This is why I keep coming back to the drug analysis, that, you know, you've got people hooked on the heroin. At a certain point, it's not enough. So you have to have, you know, the meth on the street. And then, you know, the competition between who can give you, you know, the stronger meth. And that's really when you think about, you know, Fox News, Newsmax, and OAN, they're competing for sort of the same market, but by, you know, upping the dosage or the potency of the meth that they're peddling on the street. If you're following my analogy,
my
Breaking Bad analogy, America Breaking Bad, or the right Breaking Bad.
And yeah, so you become addicted to this stuff. Yeah, then the viewers become addicted to it, right? Like then it does the calming, you know, response. You know, they turn it off, right? I don't want to watch this anymore. Like my heart rate's not jacked, you know.
Yeah, it's not like they're spending too much money. I think they should spend less money. No, it's communism, right. You know. Or you know, drop boxes are actually a good idea, and there's nothing wrong with them. It's like no, it's Jim Crow 2.0. They're gonna put you all back in chains. Okay, so. What a surprise that we're all on edge. 1 year in. I'm not going to wear the tux on the live stream tonight, though. I just got to tell you.
All right. Well, I'm hosting the live stream tonight. And we're going to get everybody else's. I've got a lot of thinkers for people. So come on, join Bulwark Plus. And I get to turn the tables on Charlie and, you know, make him answer the uncomfortable questions. Plus, there'll be a Nikola Jokic quiz.
Will there be pearl clutching?
There might be pearls tonight. I haven't decided. I haven't decided yet.
Speaking of pearl clutching, I haven't seen Peggy Noonan on television in a while. So, you know, it's like build an entire career out of pearl clutching.
I don't think that she's going to give me her pearls, sadly. I would like, somebody to bequeath me their pearls, but I think my past comments about Peggy probably are cutting me out of the will.
I think there are probably other candidates out there. Tim Miller, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow. We'll do this all over again.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's Upwork.com, Upwork.com.